This is Audible.
The Eyes of the Sphinx, the newest evidence of extraterrestrial contact in ancient Egypt, by Eric von Daniken, narrated by Danny Campbell. Copyright 1996 by Eric von Daniken. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with John W. White Literary Agency, and was produced in the year 2011 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Keep listening after The Eyes of the Sphinx for a bonus interview with author Eric von Daniken. 1. Pet Cemeteries and Empty Tombs.
Oh, Egypt, Egypt! Your knowledge will survive but in legends, which later generations will be unable to believe. Lucius Appelatius, Roman philosopher, 2nd century A.D.
Welcome to Egypt! A lanky young man with a black mustache stepped in my way and extended his hand in greeting. Somewhat surprised, I grabbed it, thinking to myself that this had to be the newest way to welcome tourists to the country. Immediately I was subjected to the typical questioning. Where was I from, and what did I intend to visit in Egypt? Jovially, though somewhat awkwardly, I got rid of this pushy fellow, but not for long. I had barely left the confines of the Cairo airport building when I was confronted by another one just like him. Welcome to Egypt! My suitcases, please. More semi-voluntary handshaking. In the days that followed, the same bothersome treatment repeated itself numerous times. Welcome to Egypt, rang from the steps of the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo. Welcome to Egypt, proclaimed the papyrus seller. Welcome to Egypt, from the shoeshine boy at the street corner, the taxi driver, the hotel receptionist, and the clerk at the souvenir store. Everyone wanted to know what country I was from, and I was getting tired of answering the same question over and over. Having my hand shaken and my origins inquired after for the 42nd time in front of the step pyramid of Saqqara, I answered solemnly, I am from Mars. Undaunted by my reply, the man grabbed both of my hands and declared emphatically once more, Welcome to Egypt! That's how far the Egyptians have come. Even tourists from Mars don't seem to be anything new. I have traveled to this country on the Nile many times in my 60 years. Many things have changed. The streets, the transportation, the polluted air, the new hotel complexes. But a shroud of mystery continues to linger over it. It still generates the same reverent fascination for which Egypt has always been known. Back in 1954, as a 19-year-old, I first descended into the subterranean tunnels under the desert sand of Saqqara. An Egyptian friend and two guards led the way. Each of us carried burning candles because 40 years ago the stuffy vaults were without electricity. The tunnels had not yet been opened to tourists. I remember very clearly how one of the guards raised his candle to highlight a massive, man-sized sarcophagus. The trembling flame reflected weakly off the granite block. What's in it? I asked hesitantly. Sacred bulls, young man. Mummified bulls. A few feet away was another wide recess in the vault with another bull sarcophagus, and yet another one across from it. Giant sarcophaguses lined the musty vaults as far as the candlelight could reach. A thick carpet of dust muffled our steps like plush velvet. More corridors, more recesses, more sarcophaguses. It felt rather spooky. The microscopic dust was irritating my throat. There was no breeze to circulate the stale, heavy air. All the coffins had been opened. The massive granite covers had been pushed aside slightly. I was eager to see one of the mummies, and asked my friend and the two guards for assistance. They raised me up until I could lie flat on the upper edge of one of the sarcophaguses. With my candle, I lit the inside of the coffin. It was squeaky clean and empty. I tried four more, with the same result.
Where were the mummified bulls? Had the huge animal corpses been removed? Were these sacred mummies now in museums? Vaguely, the suspicion arose in me that the sarcophaguses might never have held any mummified bulls. Now, over 40 years later, I was once again visiting the underground vaults. Electric lights have been installed. Tourists are channeled through 2 parallel hallways. Many of the tourists gasp in awe as the travel guide explains knowingly that each of the huge sarcophaguses used to house the mummy of a sacred Apis bull. I don't feel like contradicting the guide, even though I know better now. No mummies of sacred bulls have ever been found in the giant granite sarcophaguses. It started with Auguste Mariette. Paris, 1850. 28-year-old Auguste Mariette was employed as a science assistant at the Louvre. A short, lively man who could curse like a drunken sailor, he had accumulated a wealth of knowledge about Egypt in the past 7 years. He was fluent in English, French, and Arabic, was proficient at deciphering hieroglyphs, and was busy at work translating ancient Egyptian texts. The French had heard that the British, their fiercest archaeological rivals, were buying ancient texts in Egypt. Naturally, the French, in their grand tradition, could not allow themselves to be left behind. The Academy of Sciences in Paris decided to dispatch science assistant Auguste Mariette to Egypt. With 6,000 francs in his pockets, he was supposed to snatch the best papyri from the British. Auguste Mariette arrived in Cairo on August 2, 1850. The very next day he paid a visit to the Coptic Patriarchate, hoping to secure some ancient Egyptian papyrus texts from Coptic monasteries. While strolling through the antique shops of Cairo, he noticed that every store was selling genuine sphinxes, all of them originally from Saqqara. This started Mariette thinking. When the Coptic Patriarchate informed him on October 17th that more time was needed to decide the fate of the ancient papyri, Mariette was disappointed. He climbed to the top of the citadel, where he sat on the steps for a long time, pondering his options. Below him, Cairo was shrouded in an early evening mist. Mariette wrote that 300 minarets protruded from the dense sea of fog like the masts of a sunken fleet. In the west, he saw the pyramids bathed in the golden flame dust of the setting sun. It was an overwhelming sight. Mariette described how captivated he was, mesmerized by an almost painful fascination. It was the fulfillment of his lifelong dream. Over there, virtually within reach, lay an entire world of tombs, monuments, inscriptions, and statues. What else was there? The next day he rented 2 or 3 mules for his luggage and a donkey or two for himself. He bought a tent and a few cases of provisions suitable for desert travel, and on October 20th, 1850, he set up his tent at the foot of the Great Pyramid. 7 days later, Mariette, impatient by nature, was fed up with the hustle and bustle around the pyramids. He moved his small caravan 30 minutes journey south and set up camp in Saqqara among ruins and toppled pillars. Saqqara's modern-day trademark, the step pyramid dedicated to the pharaoh Djoser, 2630 to 2611 BC, was still hidden beneath the desert sands. Idleness was not in Auguste Mariette's character. While exploring the surroundings, he discovered the head of a sphinx protruding from the sand. Immediately, he remembered the sphinxes in the antique stores, which came from Saqqara. A few feet away, he stumbled across a broken stone tablet, from which he deciphered the word Apis. That was enough to jolt the attention of the young man from Paris. Other visitors before Auguste Mariette had seen the sphinx head and the stone tablet, but nobody had made the connection. Mariette recalled the works of ancient writers like Herodotus, around 490 to 425 BC, Diodorus Siculus, and Strabo, all of whom had described a mysterious Apis cult in ancient Egypt. In the first chapter of his geography, Strabo, 63 BC to AD 26, wrote that Memphis itself, the royal residence of the Egyptians, is also near Babylon, for the distance to it from the delta is only 3 shoni. It contains temples, one of which is that of Apis, who is the same as Osiris. It is here that the bull Apis is kept in a kind of sanctuary, being regarded, as I have said, as God, etc. There is also a Serapeum at Memphis, in a place so very sandy that dunes of sand are heaped up by the winds. And by these some of the sphinxes which I saw were buried even to the head, and others were only half visible. Can you believe it? Partially buried sphinxes? Memphis? The Apis Bull? And the Serapis Temple? Mariette was in the right place. In the 40-volume historical library authored by Diodorus Siculus, who lived in the 1st century B.C., Mariette had read about the sacred bull called Apis and its lavish burial. A lavish burial? So far, no one had found burial sites for bulls in Egypt. Auguste Mariette forgot all about the mission with which he had been entrusted by his French colleagues. He forgot about the Coptic Patriarchate and the papyri which he was supposed to copy. He had his own mission. Without hesitation, he hired 30 workers and ordered them to shovel away the sand from the small dunes that were protruding from the desert at short intervals. Auguste Mariette uncovered a large number of sphinxes, one of them about every 6 meters. An entire parade of 134 statues was unearthed. Strabo had been right after all. Among the ruins of a small temple, Mariette found some stone tablets with pictures and inscriptions. They depicted Pharaoh Nectanebo II, 360 to 342 BC, dedicating the temple to the god Apis. Mariette was certain that the tombs of the lavishly buried Apis bulls had to be nearby. The following weeks were occupied by a feverish search. Mariette made a wealth of discoveries. From the desert sands he retrieved likenesses of falcons, gods, and panthers. In a chapel of some sort he unearthed the limestone statue of an Apis bull. The bull's sculpture triggered some unexpected reactions among the women of the neighboring villages. During a lunch break, Mariette observed 15 girls and women taking turns on top of the bull. They positioned themselves on the bull's back and began moving their stomachs and thighs rhythmically against the statue. These exercises, Mariette was told, were a panacea against infertility. In his search for the entrance to the bull tombs, Mariette discovered hundreds of small figurines and amulets. Rumors started to circulate in Cairo that the nervous French archaeologist was stealing golden statues. Egyptian government soldiers on camels rode into camp to bar Mariette from further excavations. Mariette swore, cursed, and negotiated. His bosses in Paris, delighted by the reports and treasures they received from Mariette, sent him another 30,000 francs and intervened diplomatically on his behalf with the Egyptian government. On June 30, 1851, Mariette was granted permission to continue his work. Impatiently, he resorted to using dynamite so that he could listen to the sound waves reflected off the ground during the explosion. Where are the mummified bulls? On November 12, 1851, a large rock gave way under the weight of Mariette's feet. As if on an escalator, he slowly slid down into an underground vault. After the dust had settled and some torches had been lowered into the chamber, Mariette found himself in front of a recess in the wall which contained a gigantic sarcophagus. He did not doubt for a second that he had accomplished his goal. The sarcophagus was certain to harbor one of the sacred Apis bulls. As he moved closer to light the niche with his torch, he saw the huge coverstone of the sarcophagus. It had been forced out of its original position. The sarcophagus was empty. In the weeks that followed, Mariette examined the mysterious vaults methodically. The main vault was close to 300 meters long, about 8 meters high, and 3 meters wide. Large chambers branched off on both sides. Each contained a granite sarcophagus, solidly anchored at the base. A second vault, as large as the first, was opened. The 12 sarcophaguses found here had the same oversized dimensions as the 12 discovered in the first vault. These are the dimensions of a sarcophagus. Length equals 3.79 meters. Width equals 2.3 meters. Height equals 2.4 meters without the cover. Width of the sarcophagus wall equals 0.42 meters. Mariette estimated the weight of each sarcophagus at roughly 70 tons, with an additional 20 or 25 tons for the cover stone. Humongous. All the cover stones had either been partially moved aside or pushed from the sarcophagus altogether. Not a trace anywhere of the lavishly buried sacred bull mummies. Mariette assumed that grave robbers or monks from the nearby St. Jeremiah Monastery had beaten them to the sepulchres. Bitter and infuriated, he continued digging. More vaults were forced open. They contained wooden sarcophaguses from the 19th dynasty, 1307 to 1196 BC. When a large boulder threatened to halt his progress, Mariette once more resorted to dynamite. The explosive ripped a huge hole in the ground, and in the light of their torches, the men beheld a giant wooden sarcophagus below. The explosion had shattered its cover. Once the debris was removed, Mariette encountered the remains of a mummified man. According to Mariette, the mummy's face was covered by a gold mask. Around his neck he wore a gold chain with a small column made of green feldspar and red jasper. Another chain featured two jasper amulets inscribed with the name of Prince Kamwisi, who was one of the sons of Ramses II. 18 statues with human heads were scattered nearby, all with the inscription, Osiris Apis, Great God, Lord of Eternity. But it was not until the 1930s that this mummy, which Mariette assumed to be the remains of a prince, was scientifically examined. When British Egyptologists Sir Robert Mond and Dr. Oliver Myers cut apart the bandages, they were engulfed by the nauseating smell of bitumen, or asphalt. The formless mass was riddled with tiny bone fragments. Where were the sacred bulls? During the summer of 1852, Mariette discovered additional Apis sarcophaguses in a new vault. The oldest among them were dated around 1500 BC. None of them contained mummified bulls. Finally, it was on September 5, 1852, Mariette encountered two sarcophaguses that had not been tampered with. The dust on the ground revealed the footprints of the priests who had carried the sacred bulls to their tombs 3,500 years earlier. A gold-plated statue of Osiris was standing guard over the niche. The floor was covered with gold tiles which had peeled off the ceiling over the course of time. On the ceiling, Mariette recognized depictions of Ramses II, 1290 to 1224 BC, and his son offering a sacred potion to the god Apis Osiris, presented in this case as an amalgam of both. With great difficulty, the lid was hoisted off the sarcophagus with crowbars and winches. Auguste Mariette wanted to make certain that he would indeed find an Apis mummy, and therefore used extra caution. His first concern was for the head of the bull, but he found none. The sarcophagus contained a foul-smelling bituminous mass which disintegrated under the slightest pressure. This mass was permeated with a large number of tiny bones, which apparently had been fragmented at the time of burial. Amidst the array of random bone fragments, Mariette was fortunate to find 15 small figurines. The same disenchanting experience repeated itself with the second sarcophagus. No skulls of bulls, no large bones. On the contrary, he found even more tiny bone fragments. The vaults beneath the sands of Sukkara never yielded any sacred Apis bulls, contrary to everything the tourists are told, and contrary to most of the pertinent scientific literature. Today, the vaults are called the Serapium, a Greek synthesis of the words Osir and Apis Serapis. Auguste Mariette, the restless searcher who fought many battles with the Egyptian authorities, returned to Egypt after a brief trip to Paris. He had grown unaccustomed to the stuffy museum air at home. In 1858, the Egyptian government appointed him chief supervisor of all historical excavations in Egypt. Based on the recommendation of Ferdinand de Lesseps, the builder of the Suez Canal. The energetic Frenchman threw himself into his work. Under his supervision, excavations were going on at 40 different locations simultaneously, involving up to 2,700 workers. Mariette was the first Egyptologist to create a detailed catalog of all his findings. He founded the world-renowned Egyptian Antiquities Museum, and in 1879 was awarded the title of Pasha. The libretto to the opera Aida, which Giuseppe Verdi composed for the opening of the Suez Canal, honors Auguste Mariette. Unknowingly, thousands of tourists pass his grave every day. His sarcophagus is located in front of the Egyptian Antiquities Museum in Cairo. Sarcophaguses with fake mummies. In the eyes of conservative archaeologists, there is little doubt that the giant sarcophaguses at the Serapium at one time housed the mummies of sacred bulls. An expert recently hissed at me, "What else should have been in them? Nuclear waste?" I doubt that, dear gentlemen, but the solution to the mystery might come from totally unexpected corners. In order to track down the perpetrator with ironclad detective work, I first have to present some curious facts. In addition to the sacred Apis, the Egyptians worshipped two other less well-known bulls named Monivus and Bacchus. Strabo mentions the city of Heliopolis, which is situated upon a noteworthy mound. It contains the temple of Helios and the ox Minuas, which is kept in a kind of sanctuary and is regarded among the inhabitants as god, as is Apis in Memphis. Monivus was a bull without markings, but with black tufts of hair that were brushed the wrong way. A letter written by one of the temple priests at Heliopolis describes the actual mummification of the Monivus bull. The priest was confirming the receipt of 20 arm lengths of fine linen to wrap Monivus. Excavations at Heliopolis, the city of the sun god Autumn Ray, indeed revealed sepulchres of Monivus bulls. All of them had been destroyed, robbed, and pillaged. Up to this day, not one of the Monivus tombs has been found intact. The Bacchus bull was worshipped in central Egypt, not far from the modern-day city of Luxor. As is often the case in archaeology, the Bacchus catacombs were discovered by accident. The British archaeologist Sir Robert Mond had heard that a bronze statue of a bull had been uncovered near the small town of Armant. This small town is identical to the former temple city of Hermonthis, which in ancient Egypt was also called the Southern On, as opposed to the Northern On, namely Heliopolis. Sir Robert Mond calculated that there may well have been a bull-worshipping cult in the Southern On, just as there had been in its northern counterpart. The bronze statue confirmed his suspicions. He launched a methodical search. Like Auguste Mariette with his discoveries at Sukkara, the British team unearthed huge sarcophaguses in subterranean vaults located beneath the dilapidated temple ruins of Hermonthis. The sarcophaguses at Hermonthis were similar to those at Serapium in that they were built into niches on both sides of the main entrance. In consideration of the fact that the whole structure, containing 35 niches, was dedicated to the Buckus Bulls, it was named Buckium. Not far from it, Sir Robert discovered a second set of vaults, which was named Bucaria. Both structures were in extremely poor condition. Once more, grave robbers had beaten the archaeologists to the loot. Moreover, some of the chambers were partially submerged in water, and the mummies presumably had been eaten up by millions of white ants. The bronze statues that were found were totally corroded. Artifacts made of iron had been atomized. Sir Robert Mond reported that the most well-preserved body they found at the very end was that of Bucaria 32. The mummy was handled with extreme caution, and every detail was recorded. The position of the mummy did not indicate a resting bull, but rather a jackal or a dog. No bones had been broken. All of this sounds strange and confusing. The existence of the sarcophaguses is the only fact that can be ascertained. They were found at the Serapeum, in vaults below Heliopolis, at the Buckium, in Bakaria, and also in Abu Sur, near Giza. The sarcophaguses were either empty or contained a foul-smelling bituminous mass filled with tiny bone fragments. Even more confusing is the fact that a human mummy with a gold mask was found instead of the anticipated sacred bulls. Much later we learn that the bandages did not cover a human corpse either, but once more concealed a malodorous asphalt mass. And finally, the mummies, which supposedly were bulls, in reality turn out to be jackals or dogs. Unanswered questions abound. British archaeologists Mond and Myers had some of their artifacts from the Buckium and from Bucaria chemically analyzed. One piece of white glass contained 26.6% aluminum oxide, a value far too high for ordinary glass. An artificial eye made of clay contained an excessive amount of calcium, and the white of the eye, which had been assumed to be faience, turned out to be neither Egyptian faience nor glass. In contrast to genuine faience, Egyptian faience consisted of a fine quartz sand with a glass glaze. The Egyptians used it to make jewelry, most notably beads. The coverless bull sarcophaguses were made from a single block of Aswan granite. Aswan is located approximately 600 miles from the Serapeum. The mining, polishing, and transportation of even a single sarcophagus weighing 90 to 100 tons, including the lid, would have been a superhuman feat. Moreover, these monstrously heavy and bulky coffins had to be pushed, pulled, or rolled to the prepared vault and anchored into the wall recesses. Such accomplishments in terms of organization and technology underline the degree of importance in which the Egyptians conferred upon the contents of the sarcophagus. But lo and behold, the priests would cut up and virtually pulverize the recently mummified bulls into tiny bone fragments, mix them up with a large sticky blob of bitumen or asphalt, stir in some religious statues and amulets, hoist the smelly concoction into a splendid sarcophagus, and put on the lid. Just like that. If this had been the scenario, the ancient Egyptians certainly could have saved themselves the trouble of making and transporting the gigantic sarcophaguses. There was no need for colossal granite coffins to preserve some bone fragments without heads or horns for several centuries. Furthermore, the experts agree that the ancient Egyptian priests would have never dissected one of the sacred bulls. It would have been blasphemy. Sir Robert Mond indicates that it was inconceivable in ancient Egypt for a mummy to be buried in any form that would not have left his physical body intact. Nevertheless, it appears that this happened time and time again. The underground structures near Abu Sur yielded two splendidly embalmed bulls. The linen bandages crisscrossing the entire body were tied down with strings and were unsevered. Hopes were high that finally two well-preserved mummies of sacred bulls had been found. The bandages, after all, were topped by a head with horns on it. Very carefully, the French specialists, Lorte and Galliard, cut through the ancient strings and gradually peeled away the numerous layers of bandages. They were flabbergasted. The inside of the mummy exposed a hodgepodge of various animal bones from different species. The second mummy, 2.5 meters long and 1 meter wide, had all the outward appearances of a bull, but it contained the bones of at least 7 different animals, some of them calves, some bulls. All the vaults designated for the bulls had been tampered with. Had they been plundered by grave robbers? Or had monks smashed the contents of the sarcophaguses into tiny pieces? Traditionally, grave robbers have been interested almost exclusively in money and precious stones. They never cared about mummified steer. Besides, there is no reason to suspect that grave robbers would have placed an assortment of animal bones into some kind of pseudo-mummy. It would appear a bit more conceivable that God-fearing monks carried their missionary zeal a little too far, provided they knew all the entrances to the sacred bull cemeteries. The monks, in their religious fervor, could have hoisted the lids off the sarcophaguses and proceeded to crush the contents with heavy iron bars, sort of like crushing grapes. Unfortunately, this explanation does not hold water either. Such a Christian rampage would have left traces, shredded bandages, for example. Icons of the Egyptian gods would have been smashed or melted. Most likely, the pious monks would have thrown a Christian cross into the sarcophaguses to exorcise the heathen demons, or they would have left some religious statues of their own in the underground galleries. There is no indication of any such interference. Where are the mummies of the sacred Apis bulls? Contradictory sources. According to Herodotus, around 490 to 425 BC, who traveled extensively in Egypt around the year 450 BC, talking to the local priests, our search for Apis mummies is bound to be in vain. Herodotus reports that the Egyptians simply ate their sacred bulls. Male kine are reckoned to belong to Apophis, and are therefore tested in the following manner. One of the priests appointed for the purpose searches to see if there is a single black hair on the whole body, since in that case the beast is unclean. He examines him all over, standing on his legs, and again laid upon his back, after which he takes the tongue out of his mouth to see if it be clean in respect of the prescribed marks. What they are, I will mention elsewhere. He also inspects the hairs of the tail, to observe if they grow naturally. The following is their manner of sacrifice. They lead the victim, marked with their signet, to the altar, where they are about to offer it, and setting the wood alight, pour a libation of wine upon the altar in front of the victim, and at the same time invoke the god. Then they slay the animal, and cutting off his head, proceed to flay the body. Next they take the head, and heaping imprecations on it, if there is a marketplace and a body of Greek traders in the city, they carry it there and sell it instantly. If, however, there are no Greeks among them, they throw the head into the river. The disemboweling and burning are, however, different in different sacrifices. When they have flayed their steer, they pray, and when their prayer is ended, they take the paunch of the animal out entire, leaving the intestines and the fat inside the body. Then they cut off the legs, the ends of the loins, the shoulders, and the neck, and having done so, they fill the body of the steer with clean bread, honey, raisins, figs, frankincense, myrrh, and other aromatics. Thus filled, they burn the body, pouring over it great quantities of oil. Before offering the sacrifice, they fast, and while the bodies of the victims are being consumed, they beat themselves. Afterwards, when they have concluded this part of the ceremony, they have the other parts of the victim served up to them for a repast. The male kine, therefore, if clean, and the male calves are used for sacrifice by the Egyptians universally, but the females they are not allowed to sacrifice, since they are sacred to Isis. This, according to Herodotus. If he were correct, our examination of the bull necropolises would be pointless. Why would these people have gone through all the trouble with the granite sarcophaguses if the animals were intended to end up on the priests' plates? Paradoxically, the same writer, Herodotus, describes in a different passage how a bull was embalmed and how its entrails were separated from the body by flushing cedar oil through its intestines. The ancient writers were generally rather contradictory in describing the sacred bulls. While the bulls are consumed by the priests in the works of Herodotus, they are lavishly buried in the writings of Diodorus Siculus. On the other hand, ancient Roman authors like Plinius, Papinius Stratius, and Ammianus Marcellinus agree that the bulls were drowned in a sacred well. Drowned, eaten, embalmed, cut up. Which do we prefer? One ancient Egyptian source, the Papyrus Apis, details the procedure for mummifying a sacred bull. It describes the process step by step and notes how many priests were supposed to be standing in which positions. It also prescribes the way in which the bandages were supposed to be wrapped, left and right, from the top and from the bottom, as well as across. After being cleaned with water and oil, the bull had to be covered with natron until it was completely dried. During the entire ceremony, one of the priests was required to stand in front of the bull, chanting and reciting prayers and supervising the embalming process to ensure that every movement followed the prescribed routine. Once the animal was wrapped in a few thousand yards of linen, the skull was covered with plaster. A gold disc was placed between the horns, symbolizing the bull's relationship to the sun god. Finally, glass eyes were jammed into the eye sockets, and the finished mummy was carried to its prepared place in the vault in a solemn procession. All of this has been described in detail. What went wrong? Who was Omar Khayyam? An acquaintance of mine invited me to dinner in a typical Egyptian restaurant. We had rice, chicken, steamed brown beans mixed with onions, and the favorite Egyptian vegetable, molokhia. Its leaves are tasty and juicy, and it is mainly used in spicy soups or vegetable casseroles. My companion and I were enjoying a heavy, flavorful wine as he told me about the terrible times under Caliph el-Hakim, who ruled over Cairo from 996 until 1021. At the caliph's command, every person found eating molokhia was executed on the spot. Sadistically, the caliph did not merely aim to re-educate his subjects, he actually enjoyed their suffering. Ever since the rule of Caliph el-Hakim, it has been impossible politically for any Egyptian government to curtail the amount of molokhia grown. While my companion happily consumed large quantities of the green leaves, my eyes caught sight of the label on the wine bottle, which read Omar Khayyam. Who was Omar Khayyam? I believe it must be the name of the wine grower, or the wholesaler, my companion offered. One of the waiters, who had overheard our conversation, disputed this claim immediately. Omar Khayyam was a former ruler of Egypt, he said. Suddenly, the head waiter appeared at the table and dismissed his subordinate with a brusque gesture. Omar Khayyam was a famous general, he insisted. Now a guest at the next table got involved as well. Omar Khayyam? He was a Bedouin chieftain, wasn't he? I was beginning to wish I had never asked. The entire restaurant got into the act, widely speculating about Omar Khayyam. Soon the atmosphere resembled the chaos of a stock exchange floor. An admiral, someone shouted. The founder of the zoological garden, another chimed in. What are you talking about? Interrupted an older gentleman with a wide gap in his teeth. Omar Khayyam engineered the Aswan Dam. Many days later, during a conversation with Dr. Halil Ghali, the man in charge of excavation Saqqara, I asked him half in jest, who was Omar Khayyam? The district chief of archaeologists smiled and grabbed an encyclopedia. Omar Khayyam, he read. Persian poet, mathematician, astrologer, 1048 to 1122. Dealt with philosophical questions. Wrote flowery love poems. One just has to find the right people to ask. A pyramid is found. I was talking to the right person. Dr. Halil Ghali is not just any Egyptologist. According to his title, he is Director of Antiquities at Saqqara. He is a smart, pleasant, and knowledgeable man who speaks a number of languages and who even admitted to having read some of my books. Imagination is important, he said, even in archaeology. I wish there were more archaeologists like him. Saqqara has the most extensive archaeological excavation site in Egypt, the largest excavation area in the world. It starts at the border of Giza, near Abu Sir, and extends almost 40 miles south along the Nile. During the winter months, the desert sand is dredged by several international teams trying to wrest hidden secrets from the rocky ground below the sands. As late as spring of 1988, a French team from the Collège de France discovered two previously unknown pyramids from the era of Pepi I, 2289 to 2255 BC. Would you like to see the pyramids? Dr. Ghali asked. We were skimming over the sand dunes in his jeep, passing the portion of Saqqara that is open to tourists. During the ride, I learned that Pharaoh Pepi had been known for years. He succeeded Titi, 2323 to 2291 BC, who was the founder of the 6th dynasty. Titi and Pepi. I wish our current politicians had simple names like these. The pyramid of Pepi I is situated in the southern part of Saqqara, and the two pyramids found by the French team are not far from it. One is a pyramid reserved for Pepi's family. What is there to discover? I thought. Don't pyramids naturally protrude from the desert sand? It was almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The heat covered us like a sheet of hot embers, searing the pores of our skin and our scalps. The jeep came to an abrupt halt in front of a large hole in the ground. No trace of a pyramid anywhere. Dr. Ghali, my assistant Willie Dunenberger, and I approached the edge of the hole. I was speechless, not from the heat, which was heavy enough to cut with a knife, but from the sight which opened itself to my incredulous eyes about 10 meters below. We have grown accustomed to the sight of pyramids while standing in front of them, admiring their perfect contours against the backdrop of a clear blue sky. This was different. Like time travelers from a distant dimension, we were standing 10 meters above the ruins of the pyramid, which evidently had been used as a convenient quarry by nearby residents for centuries. Nevertheless, two sections of the pyramid had remained intact, displaying perfectly polished and jointed stone blocks. How long have you been digging here? The French team has been working on it for the past 6 months, together with Egyptian archaeologists and a total of 180 workers, explained Dr. Ghali. Now, during the summer, it is impossible to excavate because of the heat. The archaeologists from the Collège de France had located the pyramid under thick layers of sand and rock with the help of electronic devices. A number of new methods are available, which the likes of the 19th-century German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann could never have imagined. A magnetometer is used to determine the magnetic field of a given site. The unit of measurement is called a gamma. The Earth's magnetic field varies between 25,000 gamma at the equator and 70,000 gamma at the poles. With sophisticated processes, the gamma value of a particular site is determined and compared with actual readings taken at the site to verify if the value is consistent. If irregularities occur because of metals or hollow spaces below the surface, a ground-penetrating radar, GPR, is added. It is similar to sonar. A transmitter sends high-frequency impulses into the ground, which are reflected and measured by a special antenna. A portable computer monitors the impulses and translates them into waves and lines on the screen. If something unusual has been traced under the soil, the location of the foreign object can gradually be narrowed down with the help of GPR. In this manner, the French archaeologists found something without ever using a spade. Similarly, a team of physicians and archaeologists from the University of California at Berkeley has been working on a detailed map of the underground structures in the Valley of the Kings for the past 10 years. Tombs whose existence had fallen into oblivion for thousands of years are being located now. Underground vaults are detected through radar. It is quite conceivable that we will be able to locate more archaeological treasures in the next 10 years than have been found in the past 100 years combined. If modern-day treasure hunters search in the right places and do not spare any effort or expense, they are bound to find something. Unfortunately, some religious and political groups object to these archaeological ventures. It is generally those who are behind their times who are afraid of what the past might uncover. On the way back, I inquired after the meaning of the word Saqqara. The word is used in the old Egyptian language. Saqqara comes from the word jackal, Dr. Ghali explained. How old are the oldest of the artifacts found in Saqqara? Dr. Ghali, a very youthful-looking man, tilted his head. The history of Saqqara begins with the first dynasty around 2920 BC and extends past the birth of Jesus Christ. There are even some prehistoric findings. I was still wrapped up in the mystery of the Apis bulls, so I said to Dr. Ghali, I have studied Auguste Mariette's excavation report very thoroughly. Are you aware that Mariette never found any bulls in the Serapeum? Dr. Ghali thought for a moment. Yes, I am aware of that. Can we expect any great surprises to result from the work being done at Saqqara? The Egyptologist smiled benevolently and flashed his shiny white teeth, which sparkled like ivory under his black hair. We assume that we know about 20% of Saqqara. 80% remains untouched under the ground. Good grief, I thought. 20% and so many unanswered questions? What kind of surprises may lie in store for us in the future? How many visitors to the Pyramid of Djoser, the pyramid district of the Pharaoh Eunice, 2356 to 2323 BC, or the splendid tomb of the nobleman T in Saqqara, are aware that the ground below their feet conceals a maze of thousands of subterranean tunnels? How many of these curious travelers, exhausted by the heat, slurping sweet tea or lukewarm coke in the tourist tent, are told that millions of mummified animals of various species are entombed below the sands of Saqqara? And who would be there to tell them? In essence, they are sitting on top of an oversized version of Noah's Ark. In my opinion, the monumental sarcophaguses for pseudo-animals have a central purpose. But patience, please. I am honing in on these monsters for whom the ancient Egyptians spared no effort. Where does this obsession with mummification come from? The mummification of humans may be somewhat understandable, but animals? Body, Ka, and Ba. Much is known about the religious ideas of the ancient Egyptians from pyramid texts, an abundance of tomb inscriptions, papyri, and books by ancient authors like Herodotus. When the god Khnum, who is depicted with a ram's head, created man, he made two parts, body and Ka. The body is mortal, the Ka is immortal. The Ka is part of the all-encompassing universal spirit, the vibration, so to speak, that generate all life. The body is nothing but matter. It would be lifeless without the Ka. In contrast, the Ka is spiritual, omnipresent, and eternal. However, the Ka does not correspond to our notion of a soul. Reinhard Grieshammer, a leading authority on the subject, wrote that people wanted to perceive the Ka as a person's double or some kind of guardian angel. The only thing that is certain is that it embodies some kind of force or power. Grieshammer explains that, according to texts and drawings, the aspect of man, which we call Ka, enters the body at birth. In addition to the Ka, each person also has a Ba. This identifies a condition which is not present until body and Ka are united. The Ba could be likened to one's conscious awareness, individual conscience, psyche, or store of knowledge. Once the body dies, the Ka is united with the Ba. The ancient Egyptians used to say about a deceased that he went to his Ka. The body is nothing but an empty shell, but the Ka and the Ba are united, are eternally bonded, and appear before the gods and their ancestors in a different dimension. This ancient theory, which has been promulgated by the religions of this world for centuries in one way or another, has been rejuvenated lately. The names have changed, but the idea is the same. Physics interprets matter ultimately as vibrations. The world of the atom and the subatomic particle, which are at the root of everything, is the dimension of radiation and vibration. Example, the electron, a component of every atom, pulsates 10 to the 23rd power times per second. That's a 10 followed by 23 zeros. Physicists, ever searching for the universal formula which could explain everything and combine all knowledge, have no idea where these vibrations originate or what fuels their motion. On the other hand, esoterics and philosophers, people bound by the limitations of reason and emotion, proclaim that all is one, that everything is somehow interconnected. Tree, beast, and human all have vibrations, Ka. But the plant and the beast are released from personal liability. The actions of a tree, for instance, are neither right nor wrong, neither good nor bad, neither logical nor illogical. As a result, it never develops a psyche, an individual responsibility. It lacks the Ba. Only the trinity of body, Ka, and Ba gives each person his or her unique personality and distinguishes him or her from all others. No two people, not even identical twins, assimilate, tolerate, or register the same experience the same way. No two people suffer or rejoice with the same intensity. We are all humans, made from the same genetic material, but each of us is unique. We have become what we are. So far, so good. But none of this explains why anyone would want to mummify a dead body, an empty shell without Ba or Ka. Among ancient Egyptians, the peculiar notion arose that the Ka was still joined to the body even after death, that the Ka needed the body to return. If the Ka and the Ba were to farewell in the afterlife, the body had to be sustained. It is unknown how the Egyptians and other cultures practicing mummification arrived at this peculiar conclusion, because it ultimately contradicted their own beliefs. According to their religion, the body was worthless ballast once the Ka and the Ba left it. This new idea that the body should be preserved was directly responsible for the custom of mummifying bodies and for the heavily fortified burial vaults. The vaults were designed with traps and convoluted paths to protect them against enemies and robbers. The amount of treasure buried with a deceased person depended on his or her wealth. Not only gold, precious stones, and non-perishable foods were added to the lightless tomb, but also the descendant's favorite objects, toys, and jewelry, and even his or her bed and tools. It was considered essential that the deceased feel at home and carry with them enough objects of value for the countless offerings required on their long journey through the other world. All of this is true and documented by the artifacts found in the tombs. but it is also wrong and illogical. I am tempted to ask, how dumb do we think the old Egyptians were? Or else, what if we missed in our interpretation of burial sites and ancient texts? All explanations concerning the pomp and circumstances which the ancient Egyptians afforded their dead are built on shaky ground, contradicting all practical experience and interpretation. Why? Through the ages, graves, even the heavily protected sepulchres of pharaohs, have been plundered by greedy descendants. This is nothing new. It occurred way back in the heyday of these extensive, eccentric, labyrinthian burial vaults. By the beginning of the 18th dynasty, around 1500 BC, the tombs of virtually all political rulers had been plundered. We know from inscriptions that the pharaoh Rambai, 1319 to 1307 BC, ordered the restoration of the tomb of his predecessor, Thutmose IV, 1401 to 1391. Thutmose had only been in the grave for 80 years. The pharaohs and priests knew, without a doubt, that he had neither taken his treasures and favorite belongings into another dimension, nor used them as offerings on his way through the other world. Instead of drawing the logical conclusion that this whole mummy business was a sham, particularly since it went counter to the religious concept of the spiritual and immortal Ka, the priests doubled their efforts. They moved their burials to the Valley of the Kings near Thebes, where they chiseled underground vaults into the mountains, securing them with traps and monstrous boulders. And the dead were pampered even more. The tomb of Tutankhamun, 1333 to 1323 BC, which by some fortuitous circumstance avoided being pillaged, is a clear indication of this. It just doesn't add up. The Sleeping Dead. 26 years ago, in my book Chariots of the Gods, I expressed my suspicion, far-fetched at the time, that the ancient Egyptians chose their burial method with not a spiritual, but rather a physical reincarnation in mind. This is why the provisioning of the embalmed corpses in the burial chambers took such a practical form and was intended for a life on this side of the grave. Otherwise, what were they supposed to have done with money, jewelry, and their favorite articles? And, as they were even provided in the tomb with some of their servants, who were unquestionably buried alive, the point of all the preparations was obviously the continuation of the old life in a new life. The tombs were tremendously durable and solid, almost atom bomb-proof. They could survive the ravages of all the ages. The valuables left in them, gold and precious stones, were virtually indestructible. At the time, I referred to a book by the physicist and astronomer Robert C. W. Ettinger, who outlined a method to preserve corpses for a later revival. And today? In the United States, where else? An organization has been formed which calls itself the American Cryonics Society, ACS. Founder and president of this organization is a mathematician named A. Quafe, who steadfastly refuses to perceive death as an inescapable reality. It is the purpose of his society to preserve and freeze corpses so that they can be thawed out later, after decades, centuries, or even millennia. These kinds of experiments are in an advanced stage as far as animals are concerned. ACS member Dr. Paul Edward Segal confirms having frozen his own dog and revived it after 15 minutes, at which time the dog was perfectly fine and wagging its tail. The same process has been performed hundreds of times with hamsters. 20% of the animals survived the deep freeze. Cats, fish, and turtles have also been frozen with some success. The animals are drained of their blood, which is then replaced with an antifreeze solution. Blood would freeze, and the cells would tear. The bloodless bodies are then stored in liquid nitrogen in special tanks at minus 196 degrees Celsius. With human beings, it is conceivable that the brain and other sensitive organs would be removed from the body and stored in separate containers. A similar method is used today for the transportation of organs for transplants.
Reminiscences of Frankenstein.
Several years ago, I visited a large burial pyramid near Orlando, Florida. Instead of being buried in the ground or burned, the coffin with the remains of the deceased is placed in a refrigerated drawer. Each drawer is labeled with its occupant's personal data. The cause of death is stated as well. The center of the pyramid features a carpeted memorial hall in which the dead person's relatives can visit with their loved one anytime. Elevators connect the numerous floors inside the pyramid. The living and the dead are treated to subdued organ music 24 hours a day. What conclusions would archaeologists draw from these frozen bodies or mummified corpses in hermetically sealed drawers after 3,500 years? That's the time span from which we judge the mummifications of ancient Egyptians. Some people object that there is no comparison, because the old Egyptians also endowed their mummies with written blessings and verses for their journey through the netherworld. The Egyptian funeral books are filled with such advice and directions on how to behave in the afterlife. Does this objection hold? Anybody of sound mind who agrees to be frozen and to have his or her organs and brain preserved in separate containers after death is counting on a physical rebirth. This does not prevent relatives from adding pious verses and psalms to the refrigerated box. An inscription might read, "Look forward to life in a better world," or, "In your new life, you will be free of the illness that tortured you in this life. May the Almighty Eternal God protect you on your journey and bless you." Future archaeologists would be forced to conclude from such blessings that the deceased believed in a life after death. But is that necessarily so? How can we know for sure what motivated a pharaoh 4,600 years ago to have a luxurious tomb built for himself that was to last all eternity? Of course, everybody else wanted to follow the example of the supreme ruler and to be mummified. The original purpose, the hope of a physical resurrection, was quickly forgotten. Promoted by the priesthood, which made a large profit from the business of mummification, a cult began in Egypt which is unequaled in the entire world. The mummification business created totally new professions: embalmer, corpse cleaner, corpse cutter, and a whole industry. Sarcophaguses were made from granite, alabaster, and wood. Huge amounts of honey, wax, ointments, oils, and natron needed to be prepared. Millions of canopic urns to preserve eternal organs and brains had to be made, and several million feet of bandages and linens had to be woven. What has happened to all of these wrapped corpses? After the empire of the pharaohs was overrun by the Romans, the Egyptian priests abandoned the burial sites. Thousands of tombs were plundered. Mummies and wooden sarcophaguses were used for firewood. When Christian monks appeared in the area in the 2nd century AD, they destroyed many underground galleries filled with layers of mummies. During the Middle Ages, mummies were the in thing in Europe. They were thought to have medicinal powers. Mummy parts, mummy powder, mummy skin, and mummy paste were recommended against paralysis, cardiovascular disease, liver disease, stomach poisoning, epilepsy, and even bone fractures. This newfound market triggered a mass export of mummies from Egypt. European pharmacies squabbled over them. A small amount of mummy was an essential part of every first aid kit at home or on the road. Mummy was ingested orally or absorbed in the form of ointments or powders. This obsession with mummies as medicine, which lasted for 2 centuries, was followed by Egyptomania, a term coined by the French physician and mummy expert Ange-Pierre Leca. Mummies became highly sought-after collector's items. They were exhibited in museums and at country fairs and placed like suits of armor in the foyers of aristocratic mansions. Some were unwrapped in public ceremonies. In the 19th century, a businessman from Maine began to use mummies as the raw material for his paper manufacturing operation. He was very upset when the resins and bitumen in the mummies led to a brown discoloration in the paper. Thus was brown wrapping paper born. The brown paper, unsuitable for writing, was distributed to retailers in rolls. The mummy now served as packaging, wrapped for eternity. Millions of animals in bandages. Man is a bundle of fears, joys, sadness, and hope. Parents, lovers, children, friends die. We have no choice but to deal with the reality of death. Do people live on in some form after their death? Are they well taken care of? Are they suffering? Is death the end of it all? Or are our actions in this world judged by gods and spirits in the other world? We do not know. 5,000 years of human history have secured no answers to these timeless questions. There is no scientific evidence to support the idea of life after death, of reincarnation. I am well aware of books claiming otherwise. They derive from religious views, philosophy, esoteric theories, or personal accounts. People talk about life on the other side, about unlimited awareness and colorful spheres. People allow themselves to be hypnotized so that they may return to some of their previous existences. I have studied such experiments in detail. I have even volunteered to have myself transported back to previous lives. Some researchers claim to have been able to communicate with the dead through tape recorders. Others have managed to conjure up images of dead people on TV screens. In many of these cases, the evidence seems sensible, logical, even convincing. Unfortunately, it is useless to a scientist. Science demands reproducible evidence, unequivocal data that exclude any other interpretation except that there is indeed life after death, that there is a physical rebirth. Personal accounts with or without hypnosis are worthless to a scientist. This persistent search for answers that transcend the boundaries of our lives is due in part to a compulsive internal drive. Our personal history appears to us as too burdensome and painful. And all of this is supposed to be for nothing? A short life followed by a long death? Never. That should not and cannot be. Life must possess meaning beyond death. The ancient Egyptians were no more immune to such thoughts than we are, and those who seek answers find them. Since we stubbornly refuse to accept the possibility of a final, permanent exit, we cling to a feeble spark of hope arising in our consciousness. There is indeed a way to escape death, reincarnation. Now the unshakable belief in spiritual or physical reincarnation, life in a much better place, becomes the purpose of our lives. Hope gives us wings and carries us past the daily drudgery, pain, aggravation, and injustice. This belief in reincarnation fuels the rise of such modern-day organizations as ACS, just as it fueled religious organizations favoring mummification in the old days. All of this is understandable. I can empathize with such a thought process. After all, we are dealing here with our own self. But what in the world could motivate a culture to mummify thousands of animals? It has become an almost commonplace occurrence that some wealthy lady has her favorite dog or cat buried like a human being. An abundance of pet cemeteries attests to this. Throughout the ages, our essential loneliness has driven us to seek out a close relationship with a pet. We may call it, literally, puppy love. But is that a reason to mummify hundreds of thousands of crocodiles, snakes, hippos, hedgehogs, rats, frogs, and fish? These animals are not exactly huggable little pets. What follows is a partial listing of animals which the ancient Egyptians mummified. Bull, falcon, hippo, ram, vulture, frog, goat, owl, eel, gazelle, raven, ibis, wolf, cow, eagle, crocodile, sheep, hawk, shrew, antelope, crow, snake, dog, pigeon, cat, baboon, swallow, lynx, weasel, stork, hedgehog, rat, beetle, bat, lion, hoopoe, fish, bear, goose, fish otter, rabbit, and scorpion. One of the most famous and without a doubt most successful excavators of Saqqara was Dr. Walter Bryan Emery, 1903 to 1971. As a young Egyptologist, he was part of the team which discovered the underground passageways of the Buckium, with the sarcophaguses for the Buckus bulls under the temple city of Armant, the southern An. After 1935, he worked almost exclusively in Saqqara. He located the oldest pharaoh tombs from the First Dynasty, including the adjacent sepulchres of the pharaoh's courtiers, who had to give up their lives upon their master's demise. In the process of excavating a more recent vault from the time of King Ptolemy, 330 BC until the Roman invasion, Emery uncovered, about 1.25 meters under the ground, the remains of a young bull which had once been wrapped in burial cloth. About 6 meters below that, he found a clay jug with a conical lid. Emery cautiously brushed the dirt off the jug and noticed several more jugs just like it on both sides. Some of them bore the sign of the moon god Thoth. All in all, Emery retrieved more than 500 urns at this site. Each one of them contained the mummy of an ibis. Only a few meters east of tomb 3510 from the Third Dynasty, 2649 to 2575 BC, Emery dug down about 10 meters to discover a shaft which was filled, top to bottom, with ibis mummies. The archaeologists could not believe their eyes when they realized that the shaft they had found issued into a long, winding passageway with over 50 tributaries, which in turn diverged into a number of additional shafts. The whole structure turned out to be a maze several miles long, storing a total of approximately 1.5 million ibis mummies. Every one of these birds had been carefully prepared and wrapped in bandages before it was put into the vase. The jugs were stacked tightly from the bottom to the very top. The main passageway, with a height of 4.5 meters and a width of 2.5 meters, would have been easily accessible for a tractor. The same underground maze was described by Paul Lucas, a Frenchman traveling in Egypt at the beginning of the 18th century, as being at least 4 kilometers long. To this day, it has not been explored in its entirety. Today, sand masks the entrances once opened up by Emery. What use do we have for millions of ibis mummies? Of course, a pottery dealer may hit upon the idea of a lifetime any day now. 1.5 million vases are looking for a home. As far as quantity goes, the ibis mummies found at Tuna al-Gabel break all records. Tuna al-Gabel is near the ancient temple city of Hermopolis, about 40 kilometers south of Minya. Archaeologists located an underground pet cemetery there, covering an area of 40 acres. Through 2 shafts, the excavators entered a veritable city made of rock, featuring streets, dead-end alleys, and intricate chambers crammed with ibis mummies. However, they also found mummies of other animals, such as falcons, flamingos, and baboons. The catacombs contain at least 4 million ibis mummies. We know that Hermopolis and Tuna al-Gabel, situated 7 kilometers to the west, attracted countless pilgrims because of their sacred animal sites even in Greek and Roman times. A stele of Pharaoh Akhenaten, 1365 to 1347 BC, is considered the oldest monument of this necropolis. 1,300 years separate Akhenaten from the Romans. Just imagine the persuasive power required of a religion for it to have clung to the same icons for such a long time. Theoretically, the origins of the animal necropolis of Tuna al-Gabel may go back even further, another 1,000 years into the past. Coffins for baboons. In Abydos, we know the exact time. Abydos is situated about 560 kilometers upriver from Cairo. The site is of particular interest to archaeologists because the tombs found in Abydos date back to the 1st and 2nd dynasty, some 5,000 years before our time. Abydos was the central place of worship for the god Osiris, who was in charge of all earthly matters. Osiris is credited with introducing such useful things as farming and wine growing on earth, and therefore was called the Perfect One. Osiris had a brother named Seth, who was envious of his popularity. Seth lured Osiris into a box, cut him up into pieces, and threw the parts into the river Nile. Legend has it that his head is buried in Abydos. The first pharaohs asked to be buried near their venerated god Osiris. Excavations in Abydos yielded royal vaults of superior workmanship, as well as tombs for courtiers, high officials, and even concubines who followed their rulers into the grave. It is unclear whether their eternal devotion was voluntary or not. Whichever, it was a great honor to be buried in Abydos. Thus, it is very confounding to discover that the sacred soil of Abydos also contains thousands and thousands of dog mummies. At the turn of this century, archaeologists broke into a shaft that had been barricaded with rocks and found a system of subterranean passages, 1.5 meters high and 2 meters wide. The underground paths led to scores of burial vaults stuffed with dog corpses from top to bottom. The dogs had been wrapped in white linen and stacked in rows of 10. It was impossible to move the corpses. The mummies crumpled into dust at the slightest touch. Among the stacks of dog mummies, the archaeologists found some Roman oil lamps dating to the 1st century BC. This suggests that dog mummies were buried in Abydos for many centuries, even up to Roman times. Alternatively, it could be submitted that Roman grave robbers left their oil lamps in the musty vaults of Abydos around 100 BC. In any case, we encounter mummies of animals wherever we look, and we haven't even started looking very hard. Remember, only 20% of Saqqara has been explored. The untiring archaeologist Walter Emery, who chanced upon the millions of ibis mummies at Saqqara, scored another spectacular hit. In the process of clearing a temple dating to the times of Pharaoh Nectanebo I, 380 to 322 BC, Emery discovered a small room that provided access to lower-level passageways. Rectangular niches had been broken out of the rock on both sides of the main corridor. Each contained a wooden box with a baboon wrapped in cloth. The animal's feet were enclosed in lime or plaster, presumably to prevent the wooden sarcophaguses from tipping over. In the southeast corner, the main corridor, about 200 meters long, issued into a long room without any niches. In the light of their lamps, Emery and his crew discovered a steep step descending into a lower-level vault extending endlessly in an east-west direction. One niche after another had been hammered into the rock, and each featured an upright wooden coffin with a mummified baboon. In the process of clearing rubble out of one of the upper galleries, Emery's assistants found plaster prints of human body parts, hands, legs, feet, arms, even wigs and complete heads. The French Egyptologist Jean-Philippe Lauer, at the time one of Walter Emery's collaborators, and now the preeminent authority on Saqqara, stated that without a doubt these plaster casts were intended as medicinal votive offerings left by sick pilgrims in hope of a cure. It was their way of either communicating to their god the nature of their affliction and the specific body part involved, or expressing their gratitude for having been healed. Emery, anticipating further surprises, had the baboon galleries systematically cleaned up,